Warning, this episode contains references to abuse, kidnapping, and other themes that you may find distressing. Listener discretion is advised. Hello lovely Amy Talks fans, and welcome to my highlight show for 2021. This is a bit different to the usual end of year special I do, as I have only included clips from the episodes recorded earlier this year and one last year, and do not have any interviews with past guests. Enjoy! I want you to transport yourself back to 2020, what a tough year that was for everyone. It was also a tough year for me in many ways, so I only managed to record one interview. It was with Sudhi Karatas, an author, singer and actor. He had written a book called Rainbow Relatives, which helps children understand the various LGBT relationships that exist within society today. In the clip I've chosen, he explains some of the negative reactions to the book, and in particular, one story from a book signing. Have any audience members that you've spoken to, have they ever reacted negatively and saying, look, you're wrong, or I don't agree with this, or, you know, teaching kids about LGBT families, you know, it's too young, or have you faced any kind of resistance?
Yeah. Well, one of the, not too much, which is good, but one, there was a Barnes & Noble in the South, I think, and I was just doing a book signing there. It wasn't a some of these are in speaking engagements, some of them I'm just... They're buying the book, and I'm signing at the store or talking to people. And it was a Barnes & Noble, and she's walking by, and she sees the thing. And she says, oh, what's this about? And I said, oh, what's about talking to – it's a book on talking to kids about LGBT. And she goes, is it – what did she say? Is it progressive or conservative? And I think I kind of said, oh, is it progressive or conservative advice or something like that? And I kind of said progressive, and she kind of walked away briskly. I could tell she didn't quite – and I kind of said, well, it's good advice or whatever. Anyway, she came back a little bit later, and she said, you know, I was just asking that. I have a cousin who's gay. I love him to death, you know, but I don't think it's right to teach kids that it's an okay lifestyle and this and that. You know, my cousin has a husband, and I love them. They're great, but, and I said, well, they must not feel very comfortable in your house. Or what? Why? Well, because you don't think they have a right to be married. She was saying, basically, she believes God doesn't believe it, and now you're not going to argue with someone who's telling you they're listening to God, and if you disagree with that, you can't even have a discussion. But it was interesting. But she didn't mean harm in a way. She says, "Listen, I forget exactly what she said, but because of religion, she was a little bit. But she said, you know, I wish you luck with it, and this and that, and but I just think God feels it's wrong, and this, you know, that kind of, you know, you can't really have a discussion. But it's interesting, at one of this book events that I did in Long Island, New York, a woman asked a question along the lines of, is it a choice? Not exactly that, but I said, no, you're pretty much born that way. But anyway, she was an older woman, and she came up after to get her book signed, so she did buy a book. And she said the reason she asked that question is her granddaughter had just come out as a lesbian. She's 15 years old. And she was having a hard time, the grandmother was having a hard time accepting it. She just didn't understand it. She comes from a generation, again, where it wasn't as acceptable. But here she was buying the book and trying to understand it. So I thought that was really cool.
It's now on to my first interview of 2021, and I was very kindly recommended to Adrian by my previous guest, Sudhi. It was great to speak to Adrian about his new Christmas song, Midnight Will Be Clear, which is about gaining sobriety and being sober for Christmas. The message of the song is about hope, which is something I think we all need for the year ahead. Here he is explaining the meaning behind the song and why he wanted to write it.
What is the song Midnight Will Be Clear sort of about? What's the message?
It's about a man who became sober and for the first time, he's about to have the best Christmas of his life because midnight will be clear, meaning that he is present and clear and clarity. And so that When I heard it, I'd never heard a song. I'd never heard a Christmas song like it. And Sudie and I are both not drinkers. Like I've never had a drink. He, drinks on occasion, but we don't have an experience of the recovery community or not, nor do we have, alcoholism. But he did a twist on the Christmas song. It came upon a midnight clear, and he thought this. So he was inspired, I thought. And then, so it was. But after the pandemic happened, and releasing this song now, it just took on a different meaning. It took off a meaning
Definitely.
like where it's going to suddenly, like everything's going to be okay. Midnight will be clear. And for me, it was the midnight star, Jesus, the whole bit, but in a manger. But I thought that it's going to be okay. It's going to be fine now. The waters will be clear.
My guest for episode 33, Deanna Kloostra, is a woman on a mission to stop abusive fathers buying custody of their children, which she says happens in US courts. We spoke about her advocacy, as well as the many blogs she has written on the subject. In this clip, we discuss her own story and how the court saw in her ex-husband's favor.
I was pretty sure something wasn't quite right in my case, and everybody told me to follow the money trail. And I followed the money trail. And when I did that, I pretty much discovered, I can't get proof because I can't get into people's accounts, but I'm pretty sure that the guardian ad litem in my case sold my former spouse custody of my children and concealed my children from me. So the guardian ad litem in my case is married to the vice president of a bank. My ex-spouse's divorce attorney's law firm was in the bank. So basically they just met at the bank, at the back of the bank somewhere, and they made a deal and sold my former spouse custody because I was pretty much a stay-at-home mom, so I didn't have any money, but he has a very good job. And there were a lot of things that didn't make sense. So one of the things that doesn't make sense is that I had a personal protection order against my former spouse. And my judge ended up, she's the one who approved, actually, of the personal protection order. And then years later, turns around and gives him custody. So if there's violence in the case, they're not allowed to have unsupervised visitations, let alone custody. And the guardian ad litem in my case was actually sitting on the friend of the court, like domestic violence board. And she sat on the board with one of the two women who wrote the domestic violence manual. In our, I don't know if it was our state or if our county or whatever, but she's actually was sitting there with them.
Pamela Troutman's daughter, Alicia, was convicted of murder and sentenced to 14 years in prison for the murder of her abuser. But in fact, she was just trying to get away from him when he was accidentally stabbed. She discussed how this was a miscarriage of justice, but I wanted to share Alicia's story in this special for you if you haven't already heard it. Head to the episode notes to sign the petition, hashtag justice for Alicia. For those listening who don't know about what happened to your daughter, could you briefly explain?
My daughter was in a relationship with an older man, and she was extremely happy. And she had two younger kids that at the time that was 1 and 2, and she wanted to give them a better life. So he was from Grand Rapids, Lansing, Michigan area, and he applied for a job within his employer to be transferred to Michigan. So she went. So he had her like completely fooled, because then it's like when she got up there, it was like a 360, I say it's a 666 situation, because he just completely turned. And it's like, now the more that I think about it, it's like when he brought her to Michigan, he was expecting all these sexual things that never happened here. So I feel like my daughter was a victim of being sex trafficked, because he wanted her to have threesomes. he wanted her to have sex with other men while he watched, and she wasn't with that.
No.
So they started having altercations, and she didn't come out and tell me, and I wish she would have, because I would have came up there and got her. So one night he was like, you know how most men are, I don't want to be with you. And you know, she's like, okay, fine, because she already had a contingency plan in the back of her mind if things didn't work out, you know, what she would do. Yeah. So he saw her phone, got mad that another guy was going to come pick her up, and it got physical. He started throwing her into the walls and slamming her on the floor.
Oh my gosh. And
he finally broke away, grabbed a knife, ran downstairs, and ran outside of the house. So at that point, she cleared herself from the threat. Mm-hmm. But he took time out to put on a jacket because she didn't have a coat on. And she was standing on the steps in between their house and the neighbor's house. And he lunged at her and got stabbed. And it just so happened that it hit an artery.
Mm.
And then he died. And then she was charged with second degree murder. And the trial was a nightmare. Michigan legal system is a nightmare. So we did her state petition for appeal. It was denied. So I actually did her Supreme appeal. Because her lawyer that did it for her is like, she doesn't do that level. She said, but you have all the information that you need. And so I filled it out and I went towards ineffective counsel. And in 1995, the state of Michigan ruled that the burn in bed syndrome could be used as a defense for abused women. Mm-hmm. And so they brought up all the years that she had been abused from, you know, when she was 15, when she was with her first child's father, then her second child's father and whatnot. And I'm like, okay, you guys, you know, established that pattern, but there was no expert call, no nothing. And I also feel that the jury was brought as well, because the family came to the trial every day. And when they didn't come back for closing arguments from lunch on time, the district attorney was mad. But with any trial, the most important part is the verdict.
Yeah.
His family never showed up for the verdict. The district attorney took them into a room after the jury was given deliberation, and we didn't see them anymore because they had so many officers in the courtroom just to make sure nothing happened. And when the jury came back with a guilty verdict, the judge had this look on his face like, what in the fuck just happened? Like, he's like, I feel like she proved that it was self-defense. And so he told her lawyer to get her PSI guidelines down to the bare minimum, and he was going to go with the bare minimum.
LBC presenter, political commentator, and one half of the For the Many podcast presenting duo, Ian Dale, joined me to discuss his book, Why Can't We All Just Get Along?, all about public discourse and its decline in recent years, particularly within politics. The clip I've chosen from this interview is not about the book, but is about his career in radio and how to handle breaking news stories, which I must say he does very well.
When that airplane went down over Ukraine, or was shot down, we didn't know that it had been shot down. All we knew was that a plane had gone down. And the management said, right, you need to go into rolling news mode, which effectively means you don't talk about anything else. And that happened about 2 hours before my programme started. And even when I got on air, that's all we knew. Now, you've got to keep people listening, so you can't be too repetitive. And that really is when you earn your money. And I was also on air just after Lee Rigby was murdered. That was 3 months into Drive. Yeah. And that was probably the biggest news story I had covered up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to the end of that program, and I thought to myself, you know what, you can do this. Because even though I kind of knew that I was doing okay, there's always that little element of doubt that because you're not a trained broadcaster, because you're not a trained journalist, that you might come a cropper one day in a big way. And I thought, well, if I can handle that, I can probably handle anything.
Mm-hmm. And then I suppose you never, in a situation like that, you never truly know how you're going to react or how you're going to handle it.
And I remember one big news story where a presenter was on air and just went completely to pieces, could not string two words together. I'm not going to give any details away because it'll reveal who it was. But you do find out a lot about a presenter. And that's the thing. On a station like LBC, the management have got to be confident that whoever is on air at any time can handle a breaking news story.
Mm. Running is a sport that anyone can take up at any age. My mum is one example of this, having started running at 50 and completing the Abbots World Majors, numerous marathons around the globe, and even ultramarathons. Hear from her in this clip as she explains what inspired her to start running. Your hobby is running.
It is.
How did you, like, what was your motivation to start running? Because obviously nobody just wakes up one day and thinks, oh, I'll do a marathon. Like, how did that happen?
Well, I turned 50
mm-hmm.
13 years ago, and I decided I needed to not so much lose weight but tone up.
Mm.
I had let myself go a bit and I wasn't very happy with it. And around the same time, I also decided to stop smoking, which was one of my better decisions, obviously.
Yep.
So I looked at various gyms and I wasn't particularly a gym bunny. So I thought about running. So I went out, I bought a pair of tracksuit bottoms and a cheap pair of shoes and ran down to the end of the road and thought I was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
But being a stubborn old goat, I decided I would keep going.
Mm.
So I'd walk for a bit, run for a bit till I thought I was going to die, then walk for a wee bit more, then run for a bit. And it was hard and it felt awful, but I persevered.
Mm.
And then it got that I could run further and a wee bit further, and I walked less and I ran a bit further. And I started to see changes in my shape. And liked the way it was going, so kept it up, basically.
You can't have one without the other. Jackie Smith, the other member of the For the Many presenting duo, joins me to discuss her tenure within the UK government, including as Home Secretary. That's not what I want to highlight from our interview, though, as I want to showcase everything about her time on Strictly. You were a Strictly contestant last year. Other MPs who have been on the show have been treated as a kind of novelty act, I suppose, like Anne Widdecombe and John Sargent. So how did you differentiate yourself in that to make sure that you were taken quite seriously?
I wasn't taken seriously. I wasn't a novelty act. This is the joy of Strictly, that it is something completely out of my comfort zone. I haven't been a dancer before. You know, I did get booted out at the first opportunity, although there were fewer, my argument here is there were far fewer people in last year because of the COVID requirements. So I think it was the equivalent of going to about the third or fourth week, I reckon.
Mm.
But that was why I did it, because it was something so very different to anything that I'd done before. It's enormous fun. It's a great adventure. The clothes, the hair, the dancing, the sparkle.
It all looks lovely.
It is the people that I met, the other contestants. I mean, we're still in touch. We were just WhatsApping just this morning. it's a fabulous adventure, and I'm just so grateful to have had the opportunity to do it.
Yeah. Was it also nice kind of getting out of your bubble for a bit and seeing other people?
It was, although of course I had to go into a bubble in order to do it. So I had to move away from home. I had to live in a flat. I was in a bubble with Anton during the course of Strictly. So I didn't see other people. So that was sort of, I couldn't see my relatively new boyfriend and family members and things. So it was like a sequiny, sparkly bubble that I went into.
And how was the training? Because I've heard the training can be really intense. What was that like?
It's brilliant because I love learning new things, but it is really intense. And I only did it for a month. But, you know, getting up every day and going dancing for sort of 6 or 7 hours a day is not something that I'd ever done before. I got fit. I lost weight. I grew to love dancing. Anton was a brilliant teacher. It was something just so different to what I'd done previously. It was massive pressure, but it was a completely different sort of pressure. And that was, you know, to have that opportunity at my age, you know, I wasn't the oldest. Caroline was older than me, but, you know, I was towards the upper age group. And you don't think you're ever necessarily going to get the chance to do something like that. So when you do, it is just brilliant.
Dean Rothbart's book, September 12th, tells an incredible story of courage and resilience as on the day of the 9/11 attacks in September 2001, with the Wall Street Journal's office obliterated during the terrorist attacks on the Twin Towers, the journalists and editors amazingly managed to get the September 12th issue out on time, which earned them a Pulitzer Prize, and rightly so. I wanted to include a slightly creepy story of the last ever receipt given out at the World Trade Center, which the recipient of that receipt still has, even after all these years. It's a fascinating listen. I saw online that there was an excerpt from the book, and the lady who went into the shop in the World Trade Center still has the receipt.
Yes.
Which is amazing. Wow. You know, what a kind of weird memento to have, I guess.
Was so her name is Joanne Lippman.
Yeah.
Joanne Lippman left the journal eventually and for a time was the editor-in-chief of USA Today. She's a very accomplished journalist. On the morning of 9/11, she was shopping for mementos for her daughter's, Rebecca's, birthday, which was on 9/12. So she was in the lower concourse of the World Trade Center. And her daughter wanted a couple of locker magnets for her school locker. And Joanne was there and was in line. And people they looked out from the store to the concourse and they saw people kind of running and being shuttled out of the World Trade Center. And the cashier said to Joanne that maybe we ought to go. But Joanne insisted that she paid for, which she did. She had a $20 bill and that she paid for the magnets before they left. And so she probably does have the very last receipt of anybody from the World Trade Center stores because it was actually timed some minutes after the tower that she was in had been hit by the plane. But she insisted that she buy the magnets for her daughter. And that, again, so her daughter was turning 11. She's now, you add 20 years to that. She's now married and 31 years old. And really, one of the things that was most striking to me about writing September 12th, because we do talk about a number of different kids and how kids of the journalists, you know, 20 years later, you know, the 15-year-old is now 35 years old. And it's kind of a tale of how time passes without us even noticing it.
Janine Worth, a trauma therapist, has seen a lot of trauma in her own life. She used her knowledge and learning about the subject to help other women who are suffering with conditions like PTSD to find the strength to overcome these demons. In this clip, she tells the story of what happened to her and the choice she made to fight back against her kidnappers.
I am someone who has a long line of trauma in their family. So I had a mother who experienced trauma. I myself had a traumatic childhood. And then when I was 18 years old, it was actually the same day that I got my driver's license, I survived a hijacking, kidnapping, and attempted rape at gunpoint. There were two involved, and the one dragged me up a sand dune because they had taken us to like this beach area, very secluded area at night. And he had put his gun to my head and said, "Take off all your clothes." And in this moment, you know, we all talk about the fight, flight, or freeze response. Mm-hmm. Mine was fight. It was as if this dam of rage just broke free. And I said to him, "You will have to shoot me first." And he was so caught off guard because that's not how it's supposed to go. In his mind, the script is I cry, beg, plead, do whatever. He has his way with me, you know. And he was so like perplexed and didn't know what to do. I used that opportunity to start speaking to his friend and saying, "Take my car. You've got my cell phone. You've got my money. Just go." And started, you know, having that conversation. Eventually his friend could persuade him to not rape me, to take the car and go. And a passing fisherman actually stopped. And a friend that was with me, his brother-in-law was in the police. We could phone the police, his brother-in-law, and they started looking for my car.
Well, that's it for my highlight special and Amy Talks for 2021. It's been a great year with fascinating insight into a range of topics. Thank you so much to each and every one of my guests this year and you for listening. I hope you'll join me in 2022 for more. Subscribe to the show on all major podcast platforms. Just search Amy Talks. If you like the show, why not rate it 5 stars on Spotify and Apple Podcasts? I would really appreciate it. Keep up with the show on social media at Amy Talks Podcast on Twitter and at amytalks.podcast on Instagram. Stay safe and see you next year.